This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded with Peter Sohn, the director of the new Disney Pixar animated film The Good Dinosaur, which opens Wednesday. The main character in The Good Dinosaur is an 11-year-old dinosaur named Arlo, who's afraid of the world, unlike his mischievous siblings. Arlo's father, in an attempt to toughen up Arlo and help him work his way through his fear, takes him into the wilderness, where an unexpected fierce storm sweeps the father away, leaving Arlo alone and lost. The story follows Arlo as he tries to find his way home and has to overcome many predators and storms along the way. A feral boy named Spot, who Arlo had thought of as a rodent-like critter, befriends him and helps protect Arlo on his journey. Arlo and Spot have met up with a family of T-Rexes, and the father, voiced by Sam Elliott, has agreed to help Arlo get home if Arlo and Spot help the T-Rex family scare off the rustlers who've stolen their herd of cattle. Arlo, played by Raymond Ochoa, speaks first.
So, how far did you say that watering hole was?
I got a job for you.
I'm not really good at jobs.
I need you to keep on the dodge and sidle up the loblolly past them horn heads, just hooting and hollering and score off them rustlers. We'll cut dirt and get the bulge on them.
What? He just wants you to get on that rock and scream.
But who's out there?
They'll come right at you. You hold your ground. Don't move.
Don't move? What if they have claws and big teeth?
Don't overthink it.
Great advice.
Yeah, boy, I love that Sam Elliott. Jeez.
Yeah, I know. He's so great. Peter Sohn, welcome to Fresh Air. And, you know, the movie begins by completely rewriting history or prehistory. You know, because scientists believe that 65 million years ago, an asteroid crashed into Earth, leading to the extinction of dinosaurs and many other animals and plants. But when the film opens, that asteroid just whizzes right past the Earth. So
yeah.
Not only do dinosaurs survive, but millions of years later, they're living among people, which...
That's right.
Never really happened, except for in movies.
That's so, right.
So how did you try to imagine what life would be like if the asteroid missed the Earth and dinosaurs survived?
When you make a what-if like that, you could really go anywhere. It could be dinosaurs driving in cars and stuck in traffic, or dinosaurs in space, or whatever
right.
it was. But in the early development, I was just doing some drawings, and I started this one drawing of a long-necked type of apatosaur with his head in the ground plowing the Earth. And there was something really kind of interesting about a dinosaur having like almost like a giant tractor and farming. And so there was immediate like, oh, what if they evolved to become almost agrarian, if they're herbivores? And that started opening up other doors. If you're a carnivore, maybe you're a rancher. And there was something really sincere about this farming dinosaur. And all it was that. There wasn't a character attached to it. It was just this concept. And we would all start to connect to the kind of sincerity of a hardworking animal like that trying to survive out in the frontier.
My favorite character in the movie is actually this Dyrrhacosaurus, which looks like a hybrid of a rhinoceros and a dinosaur, but with, you know, with a lot of horns. I think it's, what, six horns or more?
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I feel like there's maybe a dozen horns, we would call the crest of the Styracosaur, and it's kind of essentially shelves that were made for all these animals.
Yeah, because the Styracosaurus in your movie collects animals to help him negotiate the wilderness. So there's like little birds and, I don't know, squirrels and all kinds of little creatures that have their job in helping the Styracosaurus protect himself. And so he's like the pet collector. would you describe creating this character?
Yeah. Our head of story, Kelsey Mann, did this one drawing of what looked like, you know, a moose or an elk. And his antlers were covered in red birds. And we kept thinking about a character that could represent Arlo, our main character, if he had been thrown out into the wilderness and was trying to survive out there. So it was what we call the end of the line Arlo. So he was gone crazy, and he's so terrified of the world that he would collect these animals as these kind of talismans to protect him from all the fears around him.
So I want to play a clip from the movie with this Dyrrhacosaurus, and you actually do the voice for this character. Yeah. So I'll ask you about the voice after we hear the clip. But just to set up the scene a little bit, Spot, the little boy, has been helping Arlo, the dinosaur, negotiate this like hostile environment, helping him find food and keeping him safe from predators. And so in this scene, Spot is helping Arlo again, and it's witnessed by this Dyrrhacosaurus who's hiding camouflaged in the woods with all these animals on his horns. And so this Dyrrhacosaurus steps out of the trees and startles Arlo and starts explaining how these different animals, the lizards, a fox, groundhog, a little red bird named Debbie, perched on his horns are actually helping him. And he points to Spot and he says, that creature, you know, that creature protected you. Like, we need that creature. So here's the scene with my guest, Peter Sohn, the director of The Good Dinosaur, also playing the role here of the Dyrrhacosaurus. The Dyrrhacosaurus speaks first.
That creature protected you. Why?
I don't know. I'm going home. Do you know how far Clawtooth Mountain is?
Good idea. We want him.
Why?
Because it's terrifying out here. He can protect me, like my friends. This is Fury. He protects me from the creatures that crawl in the night. This is Destructor. She protects me from mosquitoes. This is Dream Crusher. He protects me from having unrealistic goals. And this is Debbie. Yes, we need him.
Oh my goodness. That sounds even more crazy without the picture. Oh my goodness.
That's my favorite line in the film when he describes, when this Dyrrhacosaurus describes the Dream Crusher who he needs to protect him from having unrealistic goals. So how'd you come up with your voice?
John Lasseter was like, okay, you're doing the voice. And I was like, no, we can find a real actor. You know, this was my first time directing something. So I was just like, no, we'll find someone to do it properly. And then he was just like, no, you're going to do it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. And so much so that he would direct me to the performance. It was really funny because as I was doing it, I didn't realize that where my voice was when I was pitching it. I wasn't thinking about it. And so every time I would go, you know, Spot, I love him. Oh, John would go, lower. Spot, I love him. Lower. Spot, I love him. And I would just try to get as low as I could.
Did you base that on any horror movie characters or maybe Peter Lorre?
No, but yeah, he is kind of a Peter Lorre. Rick, we'll get you to Morocco. Yeah, there's totally a Peter Lorre thing in there.
Did you love dinosaurs as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. And my dinosaur love really came from the movies and this museum. The mounts that they have at the Natural History Museum in New York was spectacular. It was almost like action figures. There were so many different types. The species were so varied, and you would just learn every little detail you could about each one.
I know your parents are from Korea. Did they understand your preoccupation with dinosaurs? Were dinosaurs popular toys or dinosaur movies, popular movies in South Korea?
I don't know. I really, they're, you know, my parents' childhood in Korea was all war-torn. They had just come out of the Korean War. And, you know, they would always kind of, my mom would always tell me these kind, I would call them like apple slice stories, where she'd be sitting there slicing an apple and she would describe these things to me about their childhood that was very bleak and tough. And and so, you know, the things that they talked about that was like fun was like, we got an extra egg for breakfast. And you're like, oh my goodness. But at the same time, my mother, her biggest thing was going to the movies there and seeing whatever was playing in the local theater. That was her escape from all of that. And she has a lifelong obsession for movies, and that has completely infected me, you know.
The dinosaur, the young 11-year-old dinosaur, who he's afraid of everything from the moment he's hatched from his egg. He's afraid to come out of the shell. you know, as he starts to grow up, he's still afraid of everything. Could you relate to Arlo, the young dinosaur? Were you a physically confident boy? Were you a brave boy? Did people try to toughen you up?
I was a chubby kid. I'm still a little overweight. But it was, you know, a life living in shame of, I grew up in a grocery store. There was nothing I could do. It was just Twinkies every day. I mean, that's how, you know, gained this weight. But I remember not having a lot of confidence because of the way I looked and being a kind of minority in New York. And so trying to learn to be, you know, more confident and trusting in yourself was a big deal for me. And my father would get me into sports. You know, he was such a busy man. I'm working at the store, that he would still find time to push me into these things that could hopefully give me more confidence. And I feel like that test has been with me my whole life, trying to find ways to get through these little fears or big ones. And absolutely. And so, you know, I owe it all to that processed corn syrup, I guess.
Have you felt at times in your life that you had more artistic courage than physical courage?
Yes. You know, what's funny is getting into the arts. I was born in New York and my parents were born in Korea, and they came here during the 70s. And they would work very hard to create a life for us. And so the life that I think that was going to be made for me was that I was going to take over the store. And by the time I got into, you know, junior high, I knew that that was going to be my future. But I found this love for animation. It was a really sincere love for it. And I began to try to fight for this world of art, if that makes sense, knowing that culturally my parents didn't understand how you could have a career drawing cartoons. My parents didn't understand what art school really was, or just because they had, you know, They don't know what that is. You know, it was just such a innocent kind of understanding of what is animation. You could describe. I don't even think they really understand what computer animation is today. And so they would really push for me not to go into that world of art. And the more I drew, the more confidence I found in trying to fight for that.
Your parents came to the U.S., to New York in particular, in the 1970s from South Korea, and you and your brother were born in New York. You lived in the Bronx?
Yeah, that's right, the North Bronx, and my dad had a grocery store there, and we would live there. And
You lived above the grocery?
No, well, we lived close by it, but the hours are ridiculous. It would be like from 4 to 5 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. So essentially, you know, the school bus would drop us off at the store and then we would be essentially leaving there, but we wouldn't sleep there.
Mm-hmm. So describe the store. How big was it?
Boy, it was, I remember it, I don't know, it must be the size, a little bit bigger than your average 7-Eleven. And half of it was kind of the vegetables and the other half were just aisles of canned goods and boxed goods. And, you know, there would be always the classic kind of like security round mirror at every corner. Mm-hmm. And my mom was the cashier. She's been the cashier for, you know, like 30 years. They've since moved away from the grocery store. But I remember, you know, the big box above the cashier of cigarettes and everything. And then sitting next to her all the time drawing or playing on the cans or whatever that was. Talking about it like this. My father would take me wherever he needed to go. I remember going to him to the Bronx Terminal Market and remembering that stick shift to that truck that he had was like 8 feet tall, you know, and him working so hard to put all these boxes of vegetables into the truck while I was just sitting there playing with toys, and how hard he fought for our family to survive. He's an incredible man, Terry. I have unbelievable respect for what he did to come here.
I know you loved movies growing up.
Yeah.
Where did you get to see movies? On a VCR, in the theaters, on television?
There would be a kind of weekly ritual where at the end of the week, around Friday or Saturday, I don't remember, My mom would get this big kind of deposit bag from Chase Manhattan or whatever, and we'd go to the bank with this cash on some elevated train somewhere. And then she would deposit the money at the bank, and then if there was anything left over, she would take me and my brother to the movies, like all the time. She loved them so much. I can't tell you. She was such a cinephile, and it was a real experience for me because I remember that because she didn't speak English very well, she would always ask me to translate the movies for her. And so we'd be sitting in some theater in the Bronx somewhere, or Westchester, I don't remember the exact theater, but there'd be an American movie playing, and then an actor or actress would say something, and then she would lean over and ask to say, you know, in Korean, like, "Moyegyesa?" Like, what did that person say? And I would try my best to explain what was on the screen or what the character had said, and usually she kind of, like, turned away and shrugged, or she just kind of gave me a blank stare and just kind of went with the film. And so a lot of, and it went like that a lot, that she would watch movies like that, where she would kind of understand stuff or not understand any of it and then walk out. But there were some that I didn't have to translate. And honestly, the animated movies that we had seen were told so well visually that she didn't need any explanation. I remember clearly seeing Dumbo with her. And there's that scene in the movie where Dumbo's mother was caged up, and Timothy the mouse brings Dumbo over to kind of make contact, and they did this beautiful animation of these two trunks trying to reach for each other until finally the mother's trunk picks up Dumbo and swings her like it was a little like kind of bassinet. And I remember my mom tearing up at this moment, and I didn't have to say anything, and I remember, boy, she was really feeling this. And it wasn't like I understood what I was seeing with my mother at that time, but definitely I remember it affecting me.
Since you had to translate the dialogue for your mother when you went to see movies because she didn't speak English very well, did you feel in part like you were participating in the creation of the movie, like you were almost like one of the screenwriters because you had to comprehend what was being said and then translate it?
Holy cow, Terry. You know, and I never thought about that, but, you know, that this idea of, like, verbalizing stories to my mother is something that I really loved. You know, I'm sure it has a lot to do with the love for storytelling. It must be all connected to that translation aspect.
When did you start getting really serious about animation and movie making? Especially considering, as you said, like your parents were very skeptical that this could actually be a career. They expected you to take over the grocery.
Yeah, it must have been, you know, late junior high, ninth or 10th grade. Like, I had been making flipbooks before that, or trying to learn as much as I could about it. But I think it was around junior high. You know, my mother was a huge... I mean, she was really against the idea of doing any art as a viable career, and so we fought a lot about that. But boy, I don't remember the turning point of it. I just remember that my father saying, "You know what? Oh, you know what it was? There was a guy that came to the store that my father met that worked in TV animation. I think he worked for a show called The Real Ghostbusters or something like that. And he told my father that you could make a living in animation or whatever that was." And I remember I remember my father asking about schools, and I can't tell you how much that meant to me. Oh my God, Terry. Yeah, that was when then he said, "You know what, after high school, you know, you should start taking some life drawing classes," because that's what that guy said that was working in that TV show. And it was really from there that I started taking it seriously. And so, like, around the 10th grade, I would go into Manhattan to School of Visual Arts at nighttime or on the weekends to do life drawing or animating. And I made a small film, I don't know, in the 11th grade that was like, I don't know, like 30 seconds long. I remember painting the cells, like inking each cell, shooting it, and making this little film about a kind of like a mugging at a candy shop. And that was literally when it all started there.
So you have a 5-year-old daughter, and how old is your other child?
Sam is 3 years old, and they were both born under, during this production, and
So it's in some ways a kind of violent film. I mean, it's not like it's realistic violence, but this poor 11-year-old frightened dinosaur meets like one adversary after another, plus nature's pounding him with storms, and he's got a tough deal trying to find his way back home. Would you take your kids to see it, or do you think they're too young for something that could be frightening to a kid?
Both my kids did see it. My wife took them to what we call like these kind of friends and family screenings at work, and there are intense moments, and my kids loved it. I asked my wife that same question, like, did Vivian or Sam get scared at any parts? And there was a part that my son got scared at. He's 3 years old, and I remember my wife saying that, like, there's that storm section in the middle of the movie that he really started to kind of grab onto me during, and then I kind of held him and kind of worked him through, but then when he made it through the other side, he was so happy. He really loved the movie, and it really hit me again, like when we were making this film, trying to find that balance where, this film is about getting through your fears, and how do you honor that in a way to make you feel what Arlo needs to go through? And so, we would look at older movies and into our past, and I remember seeing movies like Bambi or Pinocchio, and there were these intense moments in those films too, and I remember them, and I remember like that feeling of like surviving a movie and how that felt, and it just reminded me that I, like many other kids, are resilient. But as long as the film was being honest about it, without being, gratuitous or anything like that.
Peter Sohn is director of the new Disney Pixar animated film, The Good Dinosaur. It opens in theaters on Wednesday. Amazon Prime's video streaming service has just released the entire first season of a new drama series called The Man in the High Castle. It's based on the novel by Philip K. Dick, whose stories also inspired the movies Blade Runner and Total Recall. Our TV critic David Biancooley says it's not just good, it's better than any new drama series this fall on broadcast or cable TV. Here's his review.
The executive producers of The Man in the High Castle include Ridley Scott, who directed the brilliant Blade Runner movie back in 1982, and David W. Zucker, who, with Scott, is another of the executive producers of The Good Wife on CBS. But the real workhorse here is Frank Spotnitz, who developed The Man in the High Castle for television and wrote the first two scripts. He was a writer and producer on The X-Files, and this is the show that, if life is fair, should make lots of people take notice. The Man in the High Castle is Philip K. Dick's alternative history story based on a chilling hypothetical. What if the Allies had lost World War II? The action takes place on American soil in 1962, almost a generation after the war. Back when the novel was written, that was the present day. Now it's a period piece, but that somehow makes it even more evocative. It's not the country we remember from the 60s. It's been divided up by its conquerors, with the Nazis ruling the east, the Japanese ruling the west, and a strip of desolate neutral zone around the Rocky Mountains. Both sides of the Rockies are police states, but in different ways. And there's a resistance, an underground, working to topple the oppressive governments in charge. And one of the weapons used by the resistance is a psychological one. Film canisters containing what look to be vintage newsreels, but showing an alternative history that we recognize as our own. The Nazis losing, the Japanese surrendering, and America and England emerging triumphantly. Are the films meant as cleverly staged wish fulfillments to motivate the resistance fighters? Or are they actual glimpses of some other universe, some other reality? At first, we have no idea, but it's one of the mysteries that propels this drama so intriguingly. Many of the goosebump-inducing moments in this new drama are visual and are startling. Picture this. In Times Square, a giant neon swastika emblazons a building. Or an American flag with the familiar colors, but instead of stars and stripes, there's a swastika where the stars used to be. Even the map of the former United States of America is disturbing to witness. much more so than those wind-up maps of opposing territories opening each episode of HBO's Game of Thrones. The alternative history American map in The Man in the High Castle is made even more jarring and creepy by the sound and the song that accompanies it in the opening of each episode. It's the sound of a film projector whirring into action, underscoring the importance of those illicit films, followed by the old familiar song Edelweiss, sung here in a much more haunting performance than you're used to from The Sound of Music. The three central characters of The Man in the High Castle are young people caught up in all the post-war drama and turmoil. Alexa Davalos plays Juliana, a woman who gets pulled into the resistance after coming into possession of one of those films. Rupert Evans plays Frank, a man whose proximity to Juliana has him targeted by the Nazis. And Luke Kleintank plays Joe Blake, a young man who, as we meet him in the opening episode, makes his way to a resistance leader and offers his services. The freedom fighter, played by Michael Rispoli, isn't exactly welcoming.
So this is what they're sending me now. How old are you, 28?
27.
27. What the hell are you doing here, Joe Blake?
I want my country back, sir.
You want it back? You never had it.
Sir.
You were still sucking your thumb when they dropped the bomb. It was the only country you've ever known.
Well, my father told me what it was like before the war.
Your father, huh?
He said every man was free.
How do I know you're not a spy?
A spy?
The resistance, what's left of it, is shot through with them. Half my friends are dead. Guess that's why they're down to kids like you.
I'm not a spy.
The Man in the High Castle accomplishes so much where most new broadcast TV dramas these days don't even try. As a parable about war, it's as potent as The Day After or Testament, two TV productions from the 80s that imagine nuclear bombs falling on American cities. Its use of music is clever and memorable. Early episodes make room for both the anti-lynching anthem Strange Fruit and the Japanese love song that became a number one hit in the U.S. in 1963 under the insulting title Sukiyaki. And finally, as a TV series with a captivating production design, The Man in the High Castle is as breathtakingly original as Twin Peaks and Pushing Daisies. You have to see it to believe it. And even then, like the characters who watch the film strips in The Man in the High Castle, you may not believe it. But that's the point.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches television and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. He reviewed the new Amazon original series, The Man in the High Castle. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with John Crowley, the director of the new film Brooklyn, and the star Saoirse Ronan. Ronan was nominated for an Oscar at the age of 13 for her performance in the 2007 film Atonement. She starred in the 2009 film The Lovely Bones, and in Wes Anderson's recent film The Grand Budapest Hotel, she played Agatha, the fearless and loyal girlfriend of Zero, the lobby boy. Brooklyn is adapted from a Colm Tobin novel set in the 1950s about a young woman named Eilish, who's from a small town in Ireland. Eilish is encouraged by her older sister to cross the Atlantic to New York City, where she might have a better future. After a miserable voyage by ship, she arrives in New York, homesick and disoriented. With the help of the Irish priest who sponsors her, she finds a room in a Brooklyn boarding house and a job in a department store. But loneliness is unending until she meets a young Italian man at a dance. Just as she's on the verge of starting a new life with him, she's called back to Ireland. Once there, she has to decide which life to choose, the familiarity and limitations of her hometown, or the possibilities and unpredictability of America. In this scene, Eilish has recently arrived in Brooklyn. She's talking with the priest, played by Jim Broadbent, who sees just how homesick she is.
I'd forgotten just how bad it feels to be away from home. I've enrolled you in a night class for bookkeeping at Brooklyn College. It'll be 3 nights a week, and I paid you tuition for the first semester.
Why?
Why? Not thank you.
Sorry, thank you. But why?
Well, I was amazed that someone as clever as you couldn't find proper work at home. I've been here too long. I forget what it's like in Ireland. So when your sister wrote to me about you, I said the church would try to help. Anyway, we need Irish girls in Brooklyn.
I wish that I could stop feeling that I want to be an Irish girl in Ireland.
All I can say is that it will pass. Homesickness is like most sicknesses. It'll make you feel wretched, and it'll move on to somebody else.
John Crowley, Saoirse Ronan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What personal meaning does this story have for you?
Well, when I was 27, I moved from Dublin to London to carry on directing plays. I was offered a play at the National Theatre in London. And when I moved there, I was struck by how different a city seems when you actually move there, when you don't have a return ticket, as it were. And my relationship to Ireland changed fundamentally. And I was quite struck by that. I thought homesickness was, I don't know, I suppose I thought it was the preserve of unhappy emigrants who had to leave because of economic deprivation. And because I'd been over and back to London all the time, I didn't actually think I'd feel that. And this book by Colm Tobin captures that sense of sort of displacement and doubleness that you feel when you leave your country, which is that you're obviously not from the country that you are now calling home, but equally you're not from home anymore either. You become something else, which is an exile, I suppose, for a while.
Saoirse, I know that the story of Brooklyn has personal meaning for you. Your parents came to the U.S. from Ireland in the 1980s. Your character in Brooklyn comes to the U.S. in the 1950s. Why did your parents come to America?
Like most young people, they came over to New York for work. There was a very bad recession at home in the 80s at that time, and they, you know, both left school when they were around 15, 16, and there just weren't any jobs at home, you know. So when they were in their kind of early to mid-20s, I think my dad's family knew someone over there, and this guy got him set up with a job, and him and his friend went over actually on the 4th of July, which I only found out recently, and Mam and their friend's girlfriend followed over a couple months later.
So you were born in New York, but your family moved to Ireland when you were three. Your parents returned there and took you with them. Why did they return to Ireland?
I think when they had me over here in New York, you know, my dad was working. He had been discovered, you know, while he was a bartender in this pub that he worked in by another Irish actor called Chris O'Neill. And so he had started in the theatre and was very much a part of that Irish theatre community. So for the first couple of years of my life, he was working away in America, and work was quite steady, I think, when it came to the theatre and different films that he was doing. And then the work just took him back home, and he started to get roles at home. And, you know, I think my mum, she's actually said to me, she looked at me one day, she was a nanny, and I had a cold, and it was during a brutal New York winter. And she was taking care of the other kids, and of course I was there as well. I went to work with her, and she just looked at me, and I was, you know, sick, and she thought, I can't raise my kid like this anymore. My kid needs her own couch to snuggle on, and for me to just be able to focus my time on her was something that was, you know, very important for her. And also just to know my cousins and go to an Irish school. And so we went back when I was about four.
In the story of Brooklyn, when Saoirse, your character, returns to Ireland, she's been changed by living in America. Time has elapsed. Everyone she knows has changed a little. The town has changed a little, not that much. But her experience of the town has changed a lot because of everything that she's experienced. And have you gone through similar experiences of, like, returning home and feeling different about it because of how you've changed?
Yeah, I have. Colm's writing just captures it so perfectly and beautifully, and it's so kind of heartbreaking, you know. And I think that's the real heartbreaking experience when you're homesick, is actually when you return home and you realise that you've had experiences that are now separate from this place that was so familiar to you and was very much your identity for your whole life. And Eilish actually says, when she returns back to Ireland, and there's a scene between her and Jim walking on the beach, and she says, you know, I wish it could have been like this before I left. But of course it couldn't have been, because she wasn't the person that we see kind of blossom in New York, you know. And I've been experiencing that, I suppose, my whole life. I mean, it's certainly more extreme now that I'm older and I actually lived away on my own. But, you know, from the age of about 10, just going away for a month at a time to America and working over there and having an experience that just in no way could be shared with, you know, other kids my age that I went to school with. And again, kind of like what you have to do when you move away and you leave a piece of you back at home. When you come back home then and you've had these experiences, I kind of felt like that was something that needed to be kept separate. So it wasn't really something I talked about.
Saoirse, you were not only emotionally close to the story, you were geographically close to the story. The parts in Ireland were shot, I think, within a half hour of where you grew up and where your family continues to live. Do I have that right?
Yeah, almost. My family live in Dublin now, but I grew up in County Carlow, which is one county over from Wexford. And, you know, there were times when I was a kid where the one screen cinema in our town might not have had the film that we wanted to see. So we'd go to Enniscorthy because they had, like, you know, three screens in their cinema. That was the big cinema.
That's where Brooklyn is set.
That's where Brooklyn is set, in Enniscorthy, and we shot it there. And, you know, to go there, as I said before, my childhood and that part of my life and work were always kept separate. And we moved away when I was about 18. And so that phase for me is very much in the past, even though it's something I still sort of grieve in a way. So to go back into that with work and meet people who were a part of that stage of my life that had nothing to do with film at all was very, very surreal. It really was.
I'm hearing a difference between how you're speaking now and how you speak in Brooklyn, how your character speaks in Brooklyn.
Oh, thank God. Because so many people have said to me, so how does it feel to do your own accent? And I keep saying to them, I'm not doing my own accent. I'm doing a different one.
Yeah. So what's the difference between the two?
My family are all from Dublin, and so I really kind of consider myself a Dub first and foremost. I sound like I'm from Dublin. Whereas Eilish's accent is a country accent, and it's an accent that I grew up listening to, and they can usually be very, very strong. So we didn't want it to be, we wanted people to be able to understand it, basically. So it's made a little bit gentler, and sort of the sounds are rounder and just a bit softer than my accent, which is a little bit harsher.
If you're just joining us, I have two guests. Saoirse Ronan is the star of the new film Brooklyn. John Crowley directed it. Did you talk to the author of Brooklyn, the author of the novel, Colm Tobin?
Oh, yeah, yes.
What did you get from him that was helpful in guiding you in directing the film adaptation?
We had, I mean, he was incredibly hands-off, both with me and with Nick Hornby. And he really just wanted to sit, talk about, I sort of hear the approach overall, and then give a blessing, you know. And one of the things he said to me when we had lunch together in London was, he said he thought that The Dead, John Huston's film, The Dead, was the greatest Irish film ever made. And he looked at me with a twinkle in his eye and he said, would you agree? And I said, well, I wouldn't disagree. And he said he felt it was one of the greatest films ever made because of the level of detail in the casting in every single small part. And I said, well, that I definitely would agree with, yeah. And I think he wanted to know that we would go at this with the similar eye to getting every single last part. Even somebody who has three lines would be cast as lovingly and carefully as the actor sitting in front of me, as it were. And so that you would get a complete world from it. And I guess the other thing he wanted to hear my thoughts about were music. What was the approach to music? And I was clear from that point that I didn't want the score to have a particularly strong Irish identity. When you point a camera at small town Ireland, you oftentimes it's accompanied by a tin whistle or an Uilleann pipe and a sort of plaintive, you know, Irish score. And I didn't want that. And I wanted it to have a more emotionally direct quality, and that would take us straight to the heart of Éilis, as it were. And that then in the film, you know, there's a scene on Christmas Day where we have an Irish singer who's singing in what's called the Seán Nóiseachta style, which is a very old style of traditional singing. And he's singing in Irish, a traditional song, that we would do that and do it exactly right, and that would not in any way be softened or have the edge taken off, so that it would, you would go, you know, 110% down that road when you needed to. But other than that, he was delighted to have updates. He would answer the odd question from me, the odd email.
This scene that you're referring to on Christmas Day is a very good scene. Saoirse volunteers at basically a soup kitchen at the suggestion of the priest who sponsored her trip to Brooklyn. And the priest says, these are the men who built the bridges and the tunnels and the highways. And they're clearly kind of down and out now because they're eating at a soup kitchen. And one of them gets up and sings solo. And it's a beautiful song, and everybody nearly has tears in their eyes. You could tell that song is bringing back so many memories for everybody, and that even though they wanted to leave or needed to leave home for whatever reason, that part of their heart is still in Ireland. Who is doing the singing?
He's a singer called Iarla O'Leonard, who's one of the great, great Irish singers. And he's with a band called The Gloaming. For those of your listeners who follow contemporary traditional Irish music, they might hear of them. It's like an Irish traditional supergroup, as it were. And he grew up in West Cork, in amongst the family, in Coolay, which is the Gaeltacht area, the Irish-speaking area of West Cork, and steeped in that tradition of Seán Nóiseachta singing. But equally, he's got one foot in the contemporary music world. So he was for years a member of a band called the Afro-Celt Sound System. But The Gloaming is a different kind of project. But
He's got a beautiful voice. And it made me think like with both of you, if you were nostalgic for the music you grew up on when you were in Ireland, it would probably be, you know, like pop music, you know, rock tunes. It was probably not, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it was probably not going to be like traditional Irish music because you grew up with radio and television and videos, yeah. Right?
It would be the Police would bring a tear to my eye, Terry. If you want to make me cry nostalgically, play Message in a Bottle, okay?
Oh, my God.
You know, yeah, I grew up like late 70s into the 80s, right? And for me, traditional music, and in a way, Irishness, was I was a bit embarrassed by it. I didn't really want to know about it. And it was sort of years later. This was all pre-U2 and all of that, before Irishness became a little bit cool for a minute, you know. I just made a journey back to it. And realized that it wasn't quite what I thought it was, to put it mildly.
Saoirse, you started acting when you were how old?
When I was about 8 or 9, I did a small TV show at home called The Clinic, where a lot of people actually got their start, and did that. Then I did another show the next year, and then I did my first film when I was 10. So
Atonement, which is an adaptation of an Ian McEwan novel, is the third film that you did. And in this story, your character, who's 13, wrongly accuses a young man of raping her cousin. She thinks she's right and then realizes she's wrong, but never really changes her story, and everybody suffers the consequences of this, and the consequences play out for the rest of their lives. It's a heavy role for a child to play. How old were you? Were you 13?
I was 12. I had just turned 12.
That's interesting, because usually actresses play older than the character. I mean, actresses are usually older than the character they play. You were actually a little younger.
I was a little bit younger, yeah. She was supposed to be 13, and I was completely wrong for it. You know, I physically was completely wrong for the role. Bryony in the book is described as dark-haired, brown eyes. I think she's supposed to have olive skin. And this little mole on her face was very important. And instead they cast a pale, Irish, blue-eyed, blonde-haired child. And I think that's where my love for playing someone completely different to me started, you know. I was playing someone who in every way was very different from me. I think the only thing we really had in common was the imagination. And the thing is the fascinating thing about a character like Bryony is that she doesn't really know what she's saying. There's so much that happens within one day. And, you know, we have to remember she's growing up in the 1930s in an upper middle class English family, and I'm sure whatever questions she had, nobody really answered them ever. So she sees, you know, a few pretty confusing events that take place, and her imagination, which is kind of her only friend, apart from James's character, James McAvoy's character, start to kick in, and that's what she relies on, you know. And she makes herself believe it.
How did you become an actress so young? I know your father was an actor. Did you see him act and want to do that too?
No, I didn't. Basically, when we moved back to Ireland, he was starting to be involved in Irish projects, and there was a short film that he was doing up in Dublin, and they needed a kid for the day. And he asked me to do it because they were stuck. So I did. And I just kind of took to it straight away. I felt very comfortable there. I didn't feel intimidated by it at all. And I remember there was this guy on set who, you know, would have been in his 30s or something. And he kept talking. And we were about to roll, and he kept talking, and he kept talking, and he kept talking. And we had been on set for a few hours at this stage. And I just turned to him and I just went, "Shh, quiet on the set." And I think from then on, the bug just kind of got me, you know.
Saoirse Ronan stars in Brooklyn. John Crowley directed the film. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.